Wine and the Bible, Christianity's Scanlon Error. That's the title of our series. This message in the Scanlon and Dixon story is a continuation of the whisper of an informant. You will remember that in this story, Dixon had been convicted on seemingly very solid ground. Then came an informant with new information, and the case was reinvestigated. Well, in the last message, we heard the beginning of the whisper of an informant. Here it is. Unfermented grape juice is called wine in the Bible. Unfermented grape juice is called wine in the Bible. I call that good wine. Now, we do not need to take much time to show that fermented grape juice is called wine in the Bible. That is an obvious fact that remains obvious no matter how much you research it. The proposition I want to make today that will be new to many of you is this. Fermented wine in the Bible is bad wine. Fermented wine in the Bible is bad wine. I believe it is always bad. It is never good. It is never condoned by God because it is inherently evil and has very evil potential. We will be in Deuteronomy 32 this morning. We're at the close of the life of Moses. In chapter 34, he is allowed to look at the land to which he has been leading Israel from a mountaintop. And after he has seen the land, the Lord will take him home. And in Deuteronomy 32, we have the song of Moses. Now, chapter 32 is this song, and this is his second song. He wrote one song as soon as they had crossed the Red Sea, you'll remember that. And at this time, just before he dies, he writes another song. In 32:1-4, Moses describes the God of Israel. Let's read it. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as raindrops on the tender herb, and as showers on the earth. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are justice, a God of truth and without injustice. Then in verses 5 and 6, he speaks prophetically of Israel's departure from this great God, verses 5 and 6. They have corrupted themselves. Now, it hadn't happened yet, but he's written it as though it has. They have corrupted themselves. They are not his children because of their blemish, a perverse and crooked generation. Do you thus deal with the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? Is he not your father who bought you? Has he not made you and established you? Then in verses 7 through 14, Moses recounts how God brought Israel from nothing to a great and rich nation. 7 through 14. Excuse me. Remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations, ask your father and he will show you, your elders and they will tell you, when the Most High divided the inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the numbers of the children of Israel, for the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob is the place of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in the wasteland, a howling wilderness. He encircled him. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye, as an eagle stirs up its nest, hovers over its young, spreading out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings. So the Lord alone led him, and there was no foreign God with him. He made him ride in the heights of the earth that he might eat the produce of the fields. He made him draw honey from the rock and oil from the flinty rock, curds from the cattle and milk of the flock with the fat of lambs and rams of the breed of Bashan and goats with the choicest wheat, and you drank wine, the blood of the grapes. Then in 32:15 through 29, we have a description of this rebellious nation. So let's read verses 15 through 29. But Jeshurun, that's Israel, grew fat and kicked. You know when people leave the Lord many times? When they get fat and full. And here Israel grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, you grew thick, you are obese. Then he forsook God who made him and scornfully esteemed the rock of his salvation. They provoked him to jealousy with foreign gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons, not to God. To gods they did not know. To new gods, new arrivals that your father did not fear. Now this hasn't happened yet. He's telling them what will happen. Of the rock who begot you, you are unmindful and have forgotten the God who fathered you. And when the Lord saw it, he spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and his daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be, for they are a perverse generation, children in whom is no faith. They have provoked me to jealousy by what is not God. They have moved me to anger by their foolish idols, but I will provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move them to anger by a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled in my anger and shall burn to the lowest hell. It shall consume the earth with her increase and set on fire the foundations of the mountains. I will heap disasters on them. I will spend my arrows on them. They shall be wasted with hunger, devoured by pestilence and bitter destruction. I will also send against them the teeth of beasts with the poison of serpents of the dust. The sword shall destroy outside. There shall be terror within for the young man and virgin, the nursing child, and the man of gray hairs. I would have said, I will dash them in pieces. I will make the memory of them to cease from among men, had I not feared the wrath of the enemy, lest their adversaries should misunderstand, lest they should say, our hand is high, and it is not the Lord who has done this. For they are a nation void of counsel, nor is there any understanding in them. Oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. So Moses prophesies what will happen in this nation that he found in a wasteland that he nurtured up and brought to riches, what will happen in the future. And then we have verse 30. How could one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight unless their rock had sold them and the Lord had surrendered them? How could one person chase 1,000 and two 10,000? How could it be except God had sold Israel? And then they would run. And in verse 31, he gives the reason why he sold them to their enemies. For their rock is not like our rock, even our enemies themselves being judges. Now it is verses 31 through 32 that we want to spend our time on this morning. And I'm glad I've got a lot of time this morning. 31 and 32. 32 and 33, I should say. For their vine is of the vine of Sodom and of the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall. Their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of cobras. The Lord says in this chapter that he found Israel poor and desolate in the desert, in a waste and howling wilderness. And he nurtured him up like an eaglet and is nurtured by its mother until it is ready to fly. God prospered them. He brought them to self-sufficiency. And then look back at verses 13 through 14. He made him ride in the heights of the earth that he might eat the produce of the fields. He made him draw honey from the rock and oil from the flinty rock, curds from the cattle and milk of the flock, with the fat of lambs and rams of the breed of Bashan, and goats with the choicest wheat. And you drank wine, the blood of grapes. God gave them everything they needed for a vital, godly life. And their drink was not of the vine of Sodom, it was of the vine of Israel. According to verse 14, they drank the blood of the grapes. Now that word, some of the translations say, the King James, the pure blood of the grape. That's a questionable word, hard to translate. All translations give it a good connotation. And it is used in another text, Isaiah 27:2, there translated and meaning fine or pleasant, desirable, and so on. I think what we have in Deuteronomy 32:14 is that wonderful, fresh, sweet grape juice that was treasured so highly among the ancients and among all the lands surrounding them. And when we come to the description of Israel in their departure from God, we find them depicted as drinking another kind of wine. And it is this wine we want to consider this morning. So we begin our look at fermented wine. Now the verses I'm after are verses 32 through 33. Let me read them one more time. For their vine is of the vine of Sodom and of the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall. Their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of cobras. Now whether one takes these verses as speaking of Israel metaphorically or literally drinking fermented wine or the wine of Sodom does not affect the actual meaning of what is here called the vine of Sodom. Scholars have long debated as to what is meant by the vine of Sodom. What does it mean? And I do not want to spend much time on these views other than to say I think most of them miss the intent entirely. What is this vine of Sodom? So let me give you one example from the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary. They say this fruit, referring to the vine of Sodom, grows in clusters of three or four. When mellow, it is tempting in appearance, but on being struck, it explodes like a puffball consisting of skin and fiber only. What is the vine of Sodom? Here's an explanation of what the vine of Sodom is. Now, I believe no sane person will consider that even Sodomites would make wine of something like that. If it is even possible. I doubt it's even possible. So I do not want to spend much time debating all those different views, except to say that verse 32 tells us this vine produced grapes. It produced grapes. And verse 33, that from these grapes they made wine. Now you make wine from only one thing, grapes. Anything else is not wine. So I believe that the vine of Sodom is simply the grapevine as we know it anywhere else. And I want to propose that the difference between the vine of Sodom and the vine of Israel was not in the vine, but in what they made from it. That's where the difference comes in. I believe that the vine of Sodom speaks of that vine which was used to produce fermented wine. I think the reason why commentaries struggle so hard to find some other meaning for the vine of Sodom is because they do not recognize fermented wine as bad wine. That's almost universal in the commentaries. Almost all of them agree that God permits the use of alcoholic wine. Now, let us look at these verses. Verse 32 says, "For their vine is of the vine of Sodom." Notice that it does not say Israel is the vine of Sodom. That is the error of a number of commentaries. Nor does it say their vine is the vine of Sodom. It says their vine is of the vine of Sodom. That is important. I told you about the book I bought called the Everything Wine Book. And it says that grape growers do not start their plants from seeds. Rather, they start them from cuttings. The reason for this is that if they are started from seeds, the blossoms may be pollinated from another vine of a different variety, and the seeds then have the genetic material of both kinds. So they do not start them from seeds, they start them from a cutting of a very good vine. And the book said that cuttings are more predictable. When they blossom, what they will bring forth is more predictable than if you start the vine from seed. I want you to turn to Jeremiah to see this in Jeremiah chapter 2. Here we have an example of a vine that is started from a seed. Jeremiah chapter 2. Verse 21. Yet I had planted you a noble vine, a seed of highest quality. Israel is likened to a vine from the seed of highest quality. The Lord did not plant a cutting, but a seed. And you know the biblical principle that what a man sows, he will also reap. How is it then that God sowed good seed and it bore bad grapes? How can that be? It grew from good seed. Its owner was God. But this seed was cross-pollinated with thoughts. Look at verse 20. Chapter 2, verse 20. For of old I have broken your yoke and burst, and you said, I will not transgress, when on every high hill and under every green tree you lay down playing the harlot. That's with false god. 22 through 23. For though you wash yourself with lye and use much soap, yet your iniquity is marked before me, says the Lord. How can you say, I am not polluted? I have not gone after the Baals. That's the other gods. See your way in the valley. Know what you have done. You are a swift dromedary breaking loose in her ways. So how come God planted a good plant? It was good seed, but it brought forth bad grapes. How come it was cross-pollinated from these false gods? And so in Deuteronomy 32, verse 32, what we have is a vine of the vine of Sodom. It did not grow from seed, but from a cutting. Quite predictable what this vine will bring forth. And this vine, which was of the vine of Sodom, came from the soil of Gomorrah. Not too much good you will find in those two cities. You see, this vine of Sodom and the fields of Gomorrah produced the cuttings of the vine Israel now was growing. And thus their grapes are the grapes of gall, and their clusters are bitter. Now, why did the Lord describe these grapes as grapes of gall and bitter? I believe it is because that which they made from them tasted like gall and bitter. You see, the field of Gomorrah produced the vine, and the vine produced the grapes and the clusters, and from the grapes and clusters, drink was made. And this drink is yayin, wine. And this wine is fermented wine. So verse 33 says, this wine, yayin, is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of cobras. And there you have the most precise description of fermented drink you will find anywhere. It is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of cobras. Ask anyone who has grown up in an alcoholic home, and you will find out what alcohol is and what alcohol does. Fermented wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of cobras. And serpents and cobras are a picture of the curse of God, as we learn in the Garden of Eden. You see, the difference between good wine and bad wine and the vine of Sodom and other vines is what you make of them. You see, you can have a bad TV and a good TV. Same TV, right? Depend what you use it for. Depends what you use it for. The vine of Sodom speaks of fermented wine, and fermented wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of cobras. You say, hey, just a minute. Are you not reading a lot into this passage? Well, consider first that it says their clusters are bitter, bitter. I believe that refers to what was made from them. How would they know they're bitter? Because they drank some of it. In the Everything Wine book, it says this of ancient wines. If you sipped one of those old-style wines today, you'd probably notice that it was lower in alcohol. I told you already they didn't have distilled liquors back then. You would notice that it was lower in alcohol than modern-day wines and tasted more like vinegar with a hint of cider. What's that? Bitter. Bitter. In other words, it was bitter, and we will learn later why this is so. Now the word gall in verse 32. I have to go back to Deuteronomy 32, verse 32. For their wine is of the vine of Sodom and of the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall. Their clusters are bitter. The word gall in verse 32 is the same as translated venom in verse 33. Same word. Gall and venom. Poison. Then in verse 33 we also have the word poison. Look at verse 33. Their wine is the poison of serpents. Now look at verse 24. Same chapter. Verse 24. They shall be wasted with hunger, devoured by pestilence and bitter destruction. I will also send against them the teeth of beasts with the poison of serpents. Same word. Same word that describes fermented wine here. Then look at verse 33 and you have exactly the same word. Their wine is the poison of serpents. It is poison. So what they made from these grapes was like the venom of snakes and poisonous. In the Everything Wine book is a section with this heading, How Wine is Made. Do you know how wine is made? Do you know what makes wine? Here's a section from the Everything Wine book. Let me read. Ripe grapes contain a lot of sugar, especially in hot countries. The hotter the country, the more sugar. The more sugar, the higher the alcohol content. When the alcohol content goes above about 10 or 11, then it kills itself and it doesn't ferment anymore. So you have fairly high alcohol content for those days, fairly low alcohol content for our days. There was no distilled liquor. So ripe grapes contain a lot of sugar, and the skins of the grapes are the perfect surface for natural yeast to thrive. All the conditions you need to make wine. First, you pick a bunch of grapes and crush them. Crushing releases the sugar inside the grapes and causes the yeast to come in contact with the sugar. The yeast eats the sugar and turns it into alcohol and carbon dioxide. The process is called fermentation, and it transforms plain old grape juice into sublime wine. Now let me rewrite those last sentences using Deuteronomy 32:33. The yeast eats the sugar and turns it into the poison of serpents. The process is called fermentation, and it transforms plain old grape juice into the venom of cobras. Using Deuteronomy 32:32, describing the same process. All of this adds up to the vine of Sodom, which grows in the soil of Gomorrah. Let me read for you from the Funk and Wagnalls College Dictionary on ethanol. You know, alcohol is ethanol. You buy ethanol, you'd see the poison sign on the jug. You don't see it on the wine liquors, but you'll see it on those jugs. Here we go. Funk and Wagnalls Dictionary on Ethanol and Alcohol. Ethanol is an alcohol, C2H5OH, obtained by the distillation of certain fermented sugars or starches, the intoxicant in liquors, wines, and beers. That's ethanol. When grapes or anything else ferments, yeast turns the sugar into alcohol, into ethanol, and we call it alcohol. And in fact, alcohol is poison. That's where it is. Bill McLeod, on page 26 of his little booklet, Wine the Mocker, writes, alcohol is a poison, but the only poison the government licenses for public consumption. That's alcohol. Let me give you a little more evidence for that. When someone has had too much to drink and he is inebriated, we call such a person intoxicated. Intoxicated. So what does intoxicated mean? Well, here's Funkenweigl's College Dictionary definition of toxins. Any class of more or less unstable poisonous compounds developed by animal, vegetable, or bacterial organisms and acting as causative agents in many diseases. Toxins. Why do we call a person filled with alcohol intoxicated? Why? You see, such a person is loaded with toxins, poison. He's intoxicated. He's intoxicated. We would not want to call a drunk person poisoned, would we? No. Then we can drink, right? We can continue drinking if we don't call it poison. But once we call it poison, now it somehow becomes bad. And that's exactly what it is. So we call a person like this intoxicated. The Everything Wine book has a section called The Hangover. Now, the hangover is this bad experience people go through when they've had too much alcohol in their blood. So here's the Everything Wine book. They put wine as a very wonderful substance. And listen to the beginning of this paragraph. A hangover is the body's reaction to alcohol poisoning. They got nothing to hide, these folk. They're not writing about whether it's right or wrong. They're just giving us the facts. A hangover is the body's reaction to alcohol poisoning and withdrawal. It starts from 8 to 12 hours after your last drink, page 263. You see, alcohol poisoning is what causes fecal alcohol syndrome. Melissa has told us about being at Eagle's Nest. She will meet many, many, many children with fetal alcohol syndrome. Why? Because these mothers drank alcohol while they were expecting. That's why. You think Jesus made this stuff? John chapter 2? I can't see how. Women who drink alcohol when expecting may expect babies with smaller heads and damaged brains. And a numerous other things. You see, bad wine is bad. I've got lots more to tell you. I'll tell you in another message in the future. You see, bad wine is bad. It's of the vine of Sodom. It comes from the fields of Gomorrah. That's where this stuff is made. It is poison. You cannot make anything good out of it because it is all bad. Every last particle of it is bad. There is absolutely nothing good in alcohol. There's quite a bit of bad stuff in there. And you may say, hey, just a minute. What about the French paradox? You heard about the French paradox? We will talk about the French paradox later, and I'll give you the real French paradox. Michael P. Dunlap, a clinical psychologist, says in an internet article called Biological Impacts of Alcohol Use. By the way, you go to the doctor and he says, do you smoke? No, that's good. Do you drink? No, well, that's good. All right? You say, oh, you should drink a little wine. Does he say that? Did your doctor tell you that? Michael P. Dunlap, a clinical psychologist, says in an internet article called Biological Impacts of Alcohol Use. This guy has nothing to protect either except being a doctor. He wants the good of people. He says ethyl alcohol or ethanol, known commonly as alcohol, is the same whether the beverage is wine, beer, or hard liquor. Doesn't our passage give a tremendous picture of what alcohol wine is? Their wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of cobras. That's what it is. Dr. Dunlap points out that at 0.8 blood alcohol level, you know, if the policeman stops you on the road, He thinks you've had a little too much to drink. At 0.8, he says you've had too much to drink. That's not very much. You've had too much to drive. It has affected you. You can no longer operate the way you should operate to be safe on the highway. We're going to have to charge you. At 0.8. BAL, blood alcohol level, 0.30, death can occur from poisoning. Poisoning of the body. At 0.60, most drinkers are dead. David Wilkerson talks about coming across a scene where a whole bunch of young people were dead from too much alcohol. You think Jesus made this stuff? I can't see how. Let me make another observation here. Alcohol is sometimes viewed as a stimulant. Even preachers who preach against alcohol still see it like that. Bill McLeod writes, sometimes people will defend social drinking by trying to put it on the same level as drinking tea or coffee. The argument is well known. Tea, coffee, and wine are all stimulants. Why drop one and keep the other two? By the way, I had a person call me on this. Not from here, from another place. So, how can you drink coffee? How can you drink tea? Huh? Yeah. So it has been largely accepted that wine, like tea or coffee, is a stimulant. This is what he says. There are such vast contrasts that it is amazing that anyone would use this argument. However, listen to Michael P. Dunlap again. Beverage alcohol is a drug that depresses the central nervous system like barbiturates, sedatives, and anesthetics. Alcohol is not a stimulant. Alcohol is not a stimulant. This is a doctor. There is no question that the person who drinks alcohol seems stimulated. Speech becomes free and animated. Social inhibitions may be forgotten, and the drinker can begin to act and feel more emotional, but these effects are often misleading. The stimulation occurs only because the alcohol affects those portions of the brain that control judgment. Being stimulated by alcohol actually amounts to a depression of self-control. It's not a stimulant, it's a depressant. It seems to stimulate just because it lets you do all kinds of stupid things you wouldn't do otherwise. A principal effect of alcohol is to slow down brain activity. You tell me Jesus made stuff like that. Go back with me to Deuteronomy 32. Israel as a nation has been taken in by the vine of Sodom. And in verse 28, it says, for they are a nation void of counsel. There is no understanding in them. That's what wine does. Depresses the brain. You don't think right anymore. So that is the result of the poison of wine on the body. That is the result of following a nation like Sodom and Gomorrah. Now let me show you something else. Turn to Psalm 69. Psalm 69. I appreciate those of you who have prayed for me in preparing this series. I'm amazed at what the Lord has revealed. Psalm 69, a messianic psalm speaking prophetically of Christ. References made to Jesus' thirst on the cross in verse 21, which says, verse 21, they also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. We'll talk more about this later. Let us just note here the word gall is the same word as in Deuteronomy 32, verse 32. It is poison. They gave me poison to drink. You know when they offered Jesus poison, you know what he did? He said, no, thank you. No, thank you. Listen to the New International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, not the most conservative material. Yet it says this of verse 21. The psalmist states that his enemies have given him poison for food. This is not exactly the most conservative dictionary. They have given him poison for food, translated the word as it should be. Now let me show you something absolutely incredible. The psalmist calls the poison or the alcohol, what does he call it? Food. Meat, Old King James, food. Is that a scientific statement? Listen to Dr. Michael P. Dunlap, the clinical psychologist again. Alcohol is also classified as food. Isn't that incredible? Have it described 3,000 years ago as food, and now it is described again as food here. And then he goes on to tell us why it is food. Because it contains calories. Alcohol has calories in it. Then he says, the average drink has about the same calorie count as a large potato. It's food. You drink a glass of wine, you had some food. Now listen to the Everything Wine book in a section titled Wine and Weight Loss. Listen to this. Confusion reigns when it comes to the effect of wine and other alcoholic beverages on weight loss. Wine has plenty of calories, about 100 calories a glass. So it would seem logical that if you cut out wine, you'd lose weight. Is that right? Has 100 calories per glass. You cut out wine, you're going to lose weight. Isn't that right? Stands to reason. But there's no evidence that giving up wine on your diet will necessarily help you shed pounds. In fact, a major U.S. study revealed that dieters who gave up their alcohol lost more weight than those who kept drinking. Or lost no more weight than those who kept drinking. Confusion reigns. Why does giving up wine drinking not make a difference if it is food and has 100 calories per glass? Why? William Patton. By the way, this book is going to go into our library. I want to encourage you to read it. Written in the late 1800s. He said this of wine. It will not assimilate, doesn't assimilate with the body, nor does it incorporate itself with any part of the body. And then he quotes Dr. Lionel S. Beale, physician at King's College Hospital, as saying, alcohol does not act as food. It does not nourish the tissues. This is 200 years ago, almost. Patton further quotes Dr. James Edmonds of London, who says, alcohol is, in fact, treated by the human system not as food, but as an intruder, as a poison. That's how the body treats it. It's an enemy. And it doesn't get rid of it the way we get rid of most other foods. Why does giving up wine drinking not make a difference if it is food and has 100 calories per glass? Let Dr. Michael P. Dunlap answer that question for us. Alcohol is also classified as a food because it contains calories. The average drink has about the same calorie count as a large potato. But, unlike a potato or any other food, alcohol has no nutritional value. The calories are empty. Did nothing yet. Poison. And it's empty. So alcohol has empty calories and is poisonous. Does that sound to you like something Jesus made? That sound like the best wine to you? No wonder ungodly men gave Jesus poison to drink as a food when he hung on the cross. The only value it had was to deaden his brain and pain. And do you want to know something else? When they offered Jesus alcohol, he refused it. And we'll see more of this later. Now let's go to Hosea chapter 7, verse 5. Hosea chapter 7, verse 5. One of the small books toward the end of the Old Testament. Daniel, Hosea, the first of the 12 last books in the small books in the Old Testament, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. Hosea chapter 7, verse 5. 7 verse 5. In the day of our king, princes have made him sick, inflamed with wine. The word inflamed is the word bottles in the King James Version. In Hebrew, it is kama or poisoned. Poisoned. They gave him poison. What was it? Fermented drink. You see, the word bottle is a figure of speech for what it contains. Take one more verse, Habakkuk. That's going a little further toward the New Testament. Habakkuk chapter 2. Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 15. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to your bottle, even to make him drunk. The word bottle is again the word poison. Poison. And refers to the poison of fermented grape juice. To conclude our look at bad wine, although we will have more to say on this subject later, let me read for you from Proverbs 23, 29 through 35. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaints? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long at the wine. Those who go in search of mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, fermentation. Apt description of fermentation. When it swirls around smoothly, at the last it bites like a... There you are. There's your serpent. There's the venom. And it stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, and your heart will utter perverse things. Yes, you will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, or like one who lies at the top of the mast, saying, they have struck me, but I was not hurt. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink? There's bad wine. That's bad wine. Now, some people tell me the Bible doesn't say that you shouldn't drink. This passage does. Shouldn't drink alcoholic beverages. This passage does. It said, don't even look on it. Never mind, drink them. Listen to Proverbs chapter 20, verse 1. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink is raging. And whoever is deceived thereby is not wise. So let me conclude by giving you two propositions. These are the whisper of an informant that is becoming quite excited from our first message. One, in Bible times, unfermented grape juice was called wine. Two, in the Bible, fermented grape juice is bad because it is poisonous and depresses the brain and causes one to act like a fool. It deforms babies and causes untold miseries and brings nothing good with it. It has calories that are empty and useless to the bodies, and its ethanol is poisonous and depresses the mind. That's alcohol. And maybe after this message you say, you know what? I never knew alcohol was poison. I am convinced you are right. Alcoholic beverages are condemned in the Bible. It must be so. If you are now convinced that the Bible condemns fermented wine, then you have just disqualified yourself from being either judge or jury on this case. Right? Do you follow me? Do you follow me? A good judge or good jury would listen to the end, wouldn't they? If you're convinced now, you're not a good judge and you're not a good jury. I hope someday if I get accused for murder or something, you won't be part of the judge or jury. Huh? You see, we have many difficult texts to consider yet, and you'll have to weigh out all the information before coming to the conclusion. But you say this morning, you know what? I don't care about anything further. This is enough for me. I will never view alcoholic beverages as acceptable by God. It cannot be. This is all the information I needed to make up my mind. Then I say to you, welcome to my club. You can be on my team. You can be one of my biased helpers, right? You can stand with me on this. So may the Lord bless those words, and may He use them for His honor and glory.